Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There's a deadly stretch of jungle straddling the Colombia-Panama border called the Darien Gap. If you've heard of it, you've probably shuddered at the stories of those who tried to cross it. It's a hideout for drug runners and guerrilla rebels. It's teeming with venomous wildlife. And in a reflection of the relentless wars and economic crises happening in parts of the world, the Darien Gap has become a chapter in the bigger story of what is now history's largest ever refugee and migrant crisis. Cubans, Afghanis, Somalis, Bengalis, people from every corner of the earth are trying to make it to the United States through that jungle. This hour on Point will follow the migrant trek through the Darien Gap. You can join us on air or online. No matter your position on migrants and refugees, what do you think when you watch people willing to risk drowning in the Mediterranean or dying on Mexico's so-called train of death or disappearing forever in the jungles of the Darien Gap? If Boko Haram or ISIS were coming for you, would you be willing to spend days in the jungles of Central America to get away? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining us now from Madison, Wisconsin, is journalist and filmmaker Jason Motlog. He's a former Kabul correspondent for Time magazine, and he's now an international reporting fellow at the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Jason has a story in Outside Magazine called A Terrifying Journey Through the World's Most Dangerous Jungle. You can find a link to that on our website, onpointradio.org. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Sasha.
And Jason, having read your story, it's hard even to know where to begin in terms of the horrors you describe of this place, the spider-infested mangrove swamps, the trench foot, the corrupt police, the guerrillas who've been waging war on the government of Colombia since 1964, all of these in this jungle. Tell us what this place is.
The Darien Gap is a black zone. It's one of the few places, I think, left on Earth that really can live up to that phrase. It's lawless, roadless. There are any number of things that would wish you ill there, from drug runners to leftist rebels, all sorts of criminals, bad snakes, spiders, you name it. It really is the worst of the worst.
And this is interesting. It's basically a gap in the Pan-America Highway. Tell us the history of how it came to be.
It is, yeah. The Darien Gap is about 10,000 square miles of jungle and mountain. And you know, you can take the Pan-American Highway, which is more or less continuous from the top of Alaska to the end of Argentina. It's about 19,000 miles. But there is one gap in that pavement, and that's the Darien, for about 50 miles. And there are many factors that have kept it that way. One, just the outright harsh conditions. The Spanish tried to tame it. They were ultimately run out. An expedition of Scottish explorers perished from disease. Years later, in the mid-1850s, the U.S. Sent an expedition to try and track down a canal route, and it was an ill-fated expedition, and I think 9 members died and ultimately went to Panama. So since then, it was allowed to kind of lie fallow, and into that vacuum, you see rebel groups like the FARC sort of step in, and they've been fighting the government for more than 50 years now in Colombia, and they've used that as one of their rear bases to move drugs, which have filled their war chest, arms, and other contraband. But there are also other players on the scene, rivals of theirs, who have tried to carve out territory and are now very active in the region. So it's sort of become a no man's land where there's no real authority other than those who happen to have guns.
Go back to that idea that it's a gap in a highway, because as you said, if the Pan-American Highway runs from Alaska to Argentina, we're talking about a long way. What is that, 19,000 miles, I believe?
Yeah.
How is it possible that a 50-mile gap is not doable? How is it that it's really impossible, or is there just not a will for some reason to close that gap?
There are certainly technical challenges. There are other factors, too. There's been this longstanding fear of foot-and-mouth cattle disease spreading from South America north into the United States. And so that's certainly been a factor why people aren't so eager. It's also active.
Meaning it's almost like a fire cut in the forest to prevent that disease from jumping?
It's like a, A firewall, yeah, a natural buffer. In fact, the nickname in Spanish is El Tapón, which means the plug. But it's also sort of a natural buffer for Panama. You know, Colombia has been a country in upheaval for decades, and the Darién has essentially acted as a blockade for the most part from allowing some of that unrest to spill over. So,
almost like a natural border protection created by the jungle.
That's right.
So you think the Panamanians like the fact that it's forbidding? It plays a strategic role?
To a degree, yeah. I think that's definitely a factor.
Do you think it's fair to say, you talked about the FARC and the rebels, I mean, is it essentially a war zone, or is that overstating what the gap is?
That would be overstating it. It's rife with criminality, but it's not sort of an out-and-out war zone. I mean, there's sporadic fighting. Right now, you have sort of flare-ups because the FARC is in peace talks with the government, and those are moving forward. And so there are some former right-wing groups that have just degenerated into drug gangs, very nasty groups, and they're not at the table, and they're being targeted by the government. And so now they're trying to sort of muscle into the FARC's turf and unsettle the process. So it's gotten a bit dicier of late.
It's a jungle, obviously a lot of creatures. What kind of creatures do we find in here?
All sorts of venomous vipers. We actually had to go through a snake bite workshop before we set out. We wound up bringing a refrigerated kit with anti-venom. And the short of it is that all the anti-venom we brought would not have been enough had we been bitten by certain types of snakes that are out there. We'd had 10 minutes and it would have been lights out. So snakes, lots of spiders. I had a pretty nasty spider bite that followed me back to the U.S. It didn't go away for about 3 weeks. There are jaguars who are prowling the forest. And, you know, there's that paradox where a lot of these rare species, flowers, animals are actually protected in some ways because this area has been off limits to development.
But Jason Motlogh, you decided to plunge into this forbidding place for a story.
I did. Yeah. The Darién Gap is, it's intrigued me since I was a boy. I remember reading about it, and it just was always synonymous with sort of the exotic, a kind of a heart of darkness in the Western Hemisphere. And I remember picking up the World's Most Dangerous Places guide that Robert Pelton puts out in college, and I was sort of sitting on my toilet for months and months, and that was highlighted in there. And I think that just stoked the fire. But
it enticed you rather than repelled you, or rather scared you off?
As these things do when you're, you know, in your early 20s. But, I gradually became a journalist. I think I had a healthier respect for these kinds of stories. And, you know, it was always on my radar, but it wasn't a place that I was just going to plunge in on a whim. I figured I'd get there at some point. And when I came across this article in the Wall Street Journal last year describing how migrants were coming from all over the world and filing through the Darién, I said, I have to do this. I mean, this is a story that will be an adventure. You know, it's going to be sort of expeditionary journalism, but it also has some real purpose and it's timely.
So this wasn't just a swashbuckling trip for you. This was to try to trek the migrant pass.
That's right. And I put more preparation to this trip than anything I've done before.
How much preparation?
Months.
What kind?
It took about 9 months to get off the ground. And so first it was just finding the right team, which took some doing because not a lot of people have worked in and around the Darién. And I'm going to be honest, I pitched the story to Outside cold, and I think I was trying to project that I had this whole thing under control, and I had a real game plan, and I figured, hey, I got to pitch it and get a commission first, and then I'll will it into shape.
Then I'll work out the details.
Right. So it was actually twofold. I also got a Australian broadcaster, SBS Dateline, to back a film, and so that at least got us enough funding to do this trip because it was going to be expensive.
That's right, because a cameraman accompanied you, and you have a documentary in the works as well.
Right, that's right, and that'll be out in early September. So we had a cameraman, Roger Arnold, who I knew from my days reporting in Afghanistan. And serendipity struck when I linked up with Carlos Villon, a Chilean photographer who had done a fair amount of work around the Darién over the past 10 years and had good ties with the FARC. And I had sent him an email around October, November, and I didn't hear back for some time and kind of forgot and just happened to be in New York for meetings with editors. And he reached out, and it was the last night I was there, and I thought, oh, this is fated. So we got together, had a beer. Within minutes, I knew Carlos had to be a part of this trip. And so he was going to take the pictures and sort of act as a co-producer fixer, and that really got the ball rolling.
And tell us more about your preparations. You said it took 9 months. Was that both working out the logistics? Was it finding guides? Was it figuring out how you pack, what food you can bring, what food's available on the way?
Yeah, all of the above. So we didn't know how long this trip would take. You know, we were stepping into unknown territory. No one had done it before this way with migrants as journalists. So we were kind of starting from scratch. You know, Carlos fortunately had some experience. He had tried to run the gap before and made it about halfway and had a pretty hairy encounter that sent him back. But he knew an indigenous guide who was able to give us a lot of intel, you know, the kinds of supplies we'd need, water, batteries, because there's no place to plug in and we have a lot of camera gear. And so it was pretty comprehensive. There were risk assessments involved at both ends with the magazine and with Dateline. These were pretty exhaustive. You know, some, I think, were 40, 50 pages long, but they could be boiled down into a sentence. If something goes wrong, you're on your own.
Is that right? They were pretty upfront about that.
Well, maybe not. I mean, there's a lot of language, but that's the short of it. And we found this to be true. I mean, you have satellite phones. We had a satellite GPS that we brought as a you know, secondary precaution so we could be tracked as we went in the event something happened. But we were scarcely able to get a call out once we were in the thick of it because the canopy is so dense and there's cloud cover. It's one of the wettest places on Earth. So the phone was essentially useless. Our GPS signal went cold. So if you look at the map after our trip of where we started and ended, there's this gap. And we don't know exactly where we walked because there was no way to track us.
So there is a lot that can go wrong. And in your case, little things did go wrong.
They did. Yeah. Yeah.
How long were you there total? How long did it take to get through?
It took about 3 weeks, and that's from sort of the trailhead to the terminus of the Pan American, from Turbo, this northwestern city on the Gulf of Uraba and in Colombia, and Yaviza, where the Pan American starts in Panama.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking today with journalist Jason Motlogh. His story in Outside Magazine is called A Terrifying Journey Through the World's Most Dangerous Jungle. You can find a link to that on our website, onpointradio.org. And please join this conversation. You can ask our guest about the Darien Gap, about the people he traveled with and alongside, which we're going to be hearing about. We want to know if you marvel at the fact that people leave conditions at home so desperate that they're willing to go through a place this treacherous. And later in this hour, we'll be joined by Leonard Doyle of the International Organization of Migration so that we can look at the big picture, the global problem, this massive human displacement of refugees and migrants happening now, largest ever in world history. But let's continue with Jason's story. Jason Motlogh, as we said before, you weren't going here just to write an adventure story. You had heard that many migrants and refugees go through this jungle that many people don't come out of alive to try to get to the United States. You ended up traveling with a group of migrants. Tell us about the people you accompanied, how you found them.
Yeah. So these migrant pathways, they move like water. And in our case, rules were changing while we were on the ground. And so it wasn't clear where we would link up with the migrants. We knew we had contact with the FARC that we had cultivated over many months. And they had nominally approved us to go through and do this migration story in their territory, in the depths of the Darien. A lot of the migrants typically travel along the Caribbean coastal route. It's a little easier. They can pay boatmen. But the trouble with that is that this is an area controlled by the Orbeños, this nasty drug gang. And they certainly didn't want journalists meddling around there because a lot of these migrant routes also double as drug trafficking routes. And so we stuck to the plan. We're going to go deeper into the Darien. We had to link up with our FARC contact, and we went from the Atrato River to the Cacarica River, which is a spur that turns north into the guts of the jungle. And that is where we're told a lot of the migrants have traditionally passed through. And right there at the elbow in this little riverside hamlet called Puente America, we found this old abandoned schoolroom, and the walls were covered with graffiti. It was just a gallery of the global migration story. People from Somalia, the Swat Valley in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh.
Graffiti in all languages.
In all languages, yeah. And it was, you know, a lot of nostalgia for home, but also determination to get to the U.S. by any means
necessary. The bulk of the people that use this passage are Cuban, is that right? But you also see people from elsewhere on the continent and also in Africa?
That's right. The majority, about three quarters, are Cuban. And Cubans, until I think last November, could travel to Ecuador without a visa. And a lot of them were jumping and moving north to the U.S. And I think that's largely driven by a concern that, you know, since this detente with the U.S. has unfolded, this longstanding visa policy or residency policy, where, you know, if Cubans can set foot on U.S. soil, they'll become U.S. residents, might dry up. And so more and more have been fleeing. Recently, that's changed to stem the flow, and so more Cubans are going to Guyana. That's become their beachhead, and going overland from there. So Cubans make up the bulk of the group. I'd say about 20,000 of the 25,000 or so people that Panamanians have on record is passing through the Darien last year, either through the jungle or along the coast. But they're also coming from Bangladesh, Nepal, the Horn of Africa, Nigeria, West Africa, I mean, pretty much the world over.
Which is quite amazing when you think about the distance required to get from that continent to the other continent and then to go through this incredibly menacing place. That is quite a voyage.
Incredible. Yeah, and that's what struck me when I read this story. I said, what on earth would drive somebody to take this circuitous route going south to go north, crossing oceans, and then blundering into the Darien Gap? Because as I found, almost none of these people knew of a Darien Gap. You know, it meant nothing to them. If anything, they'd maybe heard about a jungle that they had to cross once they got to Colombia.
So what's the answer to that? Why are they doing this? Is it that there's just no other way, or this is the cheapest way, or do they agree to go on this ride not knowing what they're facing?
I think that was a question I wanted to answer for sure. And I think largely there's a sense that there's still greater opportunity in the U.S. than, say, Europe. I mean, you know, it would seem the obvious choice to go to Europe if you're in West Africa, and the lion's share of people are doing that. But I think there's been a bit of a bottleneck there, and so there's this sense that, you know, if you can go get to the U.S., there's still more opportunity, an easier time of integrating. I think a lot of migrants from around the world have had a harder time doing so in Europe, and that word has probably trickled back. And I think a lot of this is just word by mouth. It's sort of evolved very organically. And, you know, in the early aughts, you saw a trickle of people taking this route from all over. But 2014, I think there were about 8,000 people. Last year, 25. So you see how it's multiplying.
Jason Motlug, let's take a caller. This is Jake calling from Spring Hill, Tennessee. Jake, welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a lot of thoughts about this, so I'll just try not to be long-winded. I guess to do the yes or no part of your question, would I take the trip? I'd like to think that I would do that for the sake of my children and for my wife. But deeper into the question, I think it's very difficult for a Westerner or a Western European or an American to answer that question, because these folks often lived in the harshest environments on the planet, and those environments are also war-torn. So they survive daily, you know, for years in environments that a Westerner probably wouldn't last two or three days in. So taking this trek is probably just mentally for them, just not easier, but they're more prepared for it than any Westerner could be. And Jason, your guest, no offense to him, but I mean, he started the trek, you know, with batteries, GPS, satellite phones, like all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure that his anxiety level and his fight or flight feeling was still pretty high. So, I don't know. I just think there's a deeper part to that question as far as perspective from their point of view and their life experience to ours.
Jake, thanks for that. And Jason, before you weigh in, I want to read a comment that came in on our website from Ari in Vermont. He says, would you be willing to spend days in the jungle? The real question is, could you? These people are the classic risk-taking American immigrants, except that they aren't white. Which gets us back, Jason, to the question, what is it that's driving people to do this? What is happening back home that's making them take these desperate measures?
Yeah, Jake, your comment's spot on, and no offense taken. You know, these people have literally been through hell. Our group, we had a couple of Gambian refugees who had been on a government hit list. There was a huge crackdown on the opposition in their country, and one of the guys who is featured in the story had to flee over in the night. He left his two children and his pregnant wife behind. He was able to get on a flight from Dakar to Madrid to Brazil, and then overland through the Peruvian Amazon, through Ecuador to Colombia. And so now he's at the Darien. I mean, considering what he's been through, it's par for the course. I met an Afghan. I used to work in Afghanistan, from Nuristan, which is one of the most tragically beautiful and hostile corners of the country. And his uncle had worked as a translator for U.S. forces and was able to get asylum and be relocated into the United States. Now, the family was facing a lot of harassment and death threats, and it just became untenable. He said he was trying to go to school and pursue an education in Kabul, and the violence there was intensifying by day, and it just got to a point where the alternative, of sticking around was unacceptable. And so that set this whole incongruous journey in motion. So these people are driven by profound desires to feel safe and to have, agility in their lives that they just don't have, and they're coming from all over.
Jason, you mentioned earlier that there's a documentary coming out that you, because you brought a photographer along on your journey, a videographer. We have a piece of sound from some of the footage you gathered. And this is that among the group of 20 migrants who you were alongside, there's only one woman, and her name was Evelyn. She said she was a hairdresser, and she told you that she was fleeing Boko Haram, the terrorist group in Cameroon. Here's that exchange.
Are you scared about this trip?
Very, very scared. But I don't have any choice. Look at the forest. I've never moved in this type of forest since I'm born. Even in Africa, I don't know this type of forest. Very hard. Too difficult for a woman. It's too much for me, too much.
You're the only woman here.
The only woman.
You're brave woman.
Thank you.
Boat. You carry me.
You're trying to go to the U.S.?
I do what? I don't have.
What can I do?
$1.
With the war that we have in Cameroon, Boko Haram killing all our brothers. We don't have no choice than to run,
yes,
to go hide ourselves somewhere.
So that was one migrant you talked to. You know, other people had other stories. They're leaving drugs or gangs, murder, torture, forced prostitution, forced enslavement, organ harvesting. I mean, things that make them think that this risking this jungle can't be as bad as what they left.
Right, right. I mean, any number of reasons driving these people, some extreme, like what Evelyn was experiencing, what Ibrima, the Gambian, was against, Zia, the Afghan I met in Turbo. But it's also important to point out that some of them are economic migrants. A lot of the Bangladeshis I met, they're coming from a place that is extremely poor, politically volatile. Right now, there's been a lot of attacks on journalists, opposition, very grisly attacks. And there's a very understandable fear of what's happening there. But also, it's a difficult place to get by. I'd done a lot of reporting on the garment industry there a few years ago with my partner, Susie. And, people are toiling away at 30 cents an hour in locked factories to sustain, our taste for fast fashion here in the West. And so if that's sort of the best case scenario for a lot of people in Bangladesh, they have good reason to try and seek better prospects elsewhere. So a lot of them said, they were facing a lot of stress because of the political climate there, but I'm not sure it was as overt as some of the other migrants or refugees I met. And for them, it was really a matter of getting to the U.S. and finding new opportunities.
Is there any data or estimates of how many people actually complete the journey or versus die or have other misfortunes happen to them along the way?
It's impossible to know. And people disappear in the Darien all the time, people far better equipped than we were. I mean, these migrants were traveling with us, so at least we were kind of a lifeline in some ways with extra food and water and bug spray and those kinds of things. But it's uncertain. We know we've heard stories of people getting lost for weeks and emerging delirious, of parties that have just vanished altogether. And Carlos, the photographer I worked with, he stumbled upon the body of a Cuban on one of his trips, just decomposing right along the trail. There are stories of migrants who have been thrown overboard on the way into the Darien by smugglers, migrants who have been killed. There's a Cuban man who was murdered and buried in the Darien. So it really is a black hole. We know, a fraction of the people that are coming through that are on record that have been intercepted by the Panamanian authorities, but I think it's really just emblematic of, part of the whole.
Let's bring in another caller. This is Barbara calling from Choteau, Oklahoma. Barbara, thanks for calling On Point.
Oh, thank you very much. And I want to say hello to both of you. I just really have a statement. I know that if I didn't live in America, I would do whatever I had to get here, risk my life, because the conditions they have to live in, the daily fear of their life. You know, they have no rights, really. They're not free people. They're just, I guess you could say, slaves in the country. And we need to stop thinking of it as people from another country and just think of it as human beings. And it's not right to see human beings go through this and not try to help them. I would rather my children die than to be in a situation like that. So I would definitely do whatever I had to do, including go out and probably get eaten by a jaguar or bitten by a snake or whatever. I wouldn't want my children to live that kind of life. So I would risk me and my children's lives in order to get here and do whatever I had to, because they just have no life over there. They're not living. They're existing. And it's not right. It's really not right. Humanity, we've all got to come together to help these people, and we've got to understand that this story really needs to be out there. People need to spread the word and let people know what's going on. You know, it's not right to the drug runners and that they can go and kill whoever they want. People can disappear and nobody knows where they went, what happened. Their life matters so little that nobody knows and nobody cares, because they're so in fear of their life they don't have time to care. And I think we just need to come together as people and realize these are human beings. And if this was your mother, your sister, your father, whatever, you wouldn't want them to live like that. And you would probably want them to try their best to get away. I know, you know, and I know it sounds horrible that I would prefer my family to die than to live like that. But, you know, coming to America, this is a wonderful country, freedoms and rights, and we take care of people. Maybe we don't do it the best, maybe we make mistakes, but we try to take care of our people. And America really, you know, has to watch over other countries.
Barbara, thank you for adding that human dimension to it. And I want to actually bring in another guest who can talk a bit about why we're seeing people willing to take these risks. This is Leonard Doyle. He's the Director of Media and Communication for the International Organization for Migration. He joins us from Geneva, Switzerland. Leonard, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Sasha, for having me on. It's a pleasure.
And Leonard, I want to throw out a striking number, which is that the United States estimates that 65 million people are now in flight because of war or persecution or terror. It's considered the largest displacement in human history. Give us a sense of where we are in a moment of history in terms of people trying to get away from where they are to go to better places.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the number has risen sharply. I mean, there is, broadly speaking, an arc of instability from the Himalayas, from Afghanistan, if you will, all the way through the Middle East, take that line through North Africa and take it down to Nigeria and indeed further south. And right along that line you find instability, whether it's due to insurrection, due to civil war, due to onset of climate change in some cases, or due to local corruption and people having no hope for their lives. So put all that together and you have a cauldron of instability, and people are voting with their feet, as we've heard described a little while ago.
We've heard so much in the news lately about migrants who end up drowning in the Mediterranean. A lot of times people trying to get places on boats. We hear less lately about places like the jungle. Are you finding that people are looking for different paths? Are the conventional routes being blocked? Why do we see people looking for new ways in all the time?
Well, if by the jungle you mean the famous campsite in Calais, where people were camped out trying to get to the UK, that's becoming more under control. And in fact, the numbers there were always quite small, 2,000 or 3,000 people. I think it was more of a media story than reality, especially in the context of the British election. But what we're seeing now is, as you've been describing, as Jason has been describing in this fascinating program, is more and more people from around the world are trying to make it directly to the United States, and they're doing it through, if possible, the Darien Gap. I mean, we learned today that 8 people have been found dead, 8 people probably of African origin, but potentially Haitians, including one woman in a Lake Cocibulca in southern Nicaragua. So these are people who'd crossed over from Costa Rica into Nicaragua and tragically drowned, but they probably already made the journey through the Darien Gap that we've been hearing about.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the on-the-ground stories of migrants and refugees and then the big picture reasons for what is now the biggest human migration in history. You can join the conversation. Let us know if you think we should help when these people arrive on our doorstep. Is there reason to be compassionate? Or if they do not arrive illegally, do we simply need to say you have to come in legal ways? My two guests are journalist-filmmaker Jason Motlog, who wrote a story about this migrant trek through the Darien Gap in Outside Magazine, and also Leonard Doyle, director of media and communication for the International Organization for Migration. And Jason, I want to start with two more pieces of sound gathered in the footage that you had a cameraman gather, because there's a documentary in the works about what you've done. These are conversations with migrants who are explaining why they made this trip, and you're hearing some of the emotion they feel as they make it. First one is a man named Arafat. He was one of a group of Bangladeshi men that made the trek across the Darien Gap. And he was sobbing as the cameraman filmed him, as he talked and reflected on the family he had left behind. Specifically, he's saying that he left his father, his mother, his brother, and his sister to come here. He's on his own. Here's another person, Abrima. This person claims to be on a government hit list in his native Gambia. In this footage, which we can't see, obviously, he's sprawled on the floor of the jungle. He has his head on his backpack. He's taken a break, very soaked in sweat. And he's very patiently telling our guest, Jason Motlog, that there's no way that he's in the mood to answer a how-do-you-feel question from a reporter.
Because right now, I cannot talk. I'm very tired, you know. Tired. The jungle is not easy.
Leonard Doyle, before the break, I had made a reference to a jungle, and you had suggested that I was referring to the refugee camp in Calais, France, nicknamed the jungle. I meant the literal jungle, which is the Darien Gap. Can you tell us whether, because there are so many routes that people are dying on, routes that countries are cracking down on, do you see more people reaching out for sort of the most treacherous, the most dangerous types of routes that in the past maybe people wouldn't have considered, routes like the Darien Gap, because they're so desperate?
Well, that's definitely what we're seeing. And the evidence of that in some respects is the numbers of people who are dying. We at IOM have counted over 4,000 deaths this year alone. Now, most of those, I have to say, are in the Mediterranean, but a sizable number are happening in Central America and in other parts of the world. The Darien Gap clearly is part of that tragedy. I've just mentioned the eight who were found dead yesterday in the Nicaraguan border. But at the same time, as these people are desperately trying to get to a better life, be they refugees or economic migrants, the governments are also busy sending them home. I mean, Colombia has deported about 9,000 Haitians, Cubans, Nepalese, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, etc. in the last year. And indeed, there are over 1,200 Cubans stuck in Colombia at the moment, probably destined to be sent home to Ecuador, which is where they went to from Cuba. And they're mostly economic migrants at the end of the day.
Leonard, would you also explain how some people end up being offered passage by smugglers through Facebook?
Well, I mean, this is the downside of the new media that we're experiencing. So as Facebook grows exponentially and as it becomes a wonderful tool for self-expression and communication, indeed many people around the world see it, call Facebook the internet. At the same time, you know, it's putting devices and the internet into the hands of very vulnerable people who are vulnerable to exploitation. So, you know, if you're in a hard place, if you're stuck somewhere and you see a message on Facebook put there by a smuggler, you probably believe it. You may not believe your government. You may not believe the message that it's a dangerous journey, it's a dangerous route. You'll believe the promise of a bright new life. And I think something has to happen here. I think the social media companies at some point, given that they are now very much taking over great swathes of the media, there needs to be a bit more accountability and a bit more helping people understand that just because a smuggler promises you nirvana doesn't mean you're going to get there. You may end up drowned in the Darien Gap.
How much are smugglers charging to claim they will take people to their destination?
It very much depends on the place, the time, and the migrant involved. If you're a Syrian trying to get, you know, from Libya to the Mediterranean, they might charge $7,000, $4,000 from Turkey into Greece, although that route is now pretty much closed down. But if they see that you're an indigent person from another country, they might say, you know, $400. But one thing for sure is that they will shake you down as hard as possible. They'll take your phone. They'll insist that you call your family. If you have relatives in the West, they'll organize for them to pay you off through money transfer. It's a totally exploitative racket. And to deny that is kind of, I think, naive. And I think we need to see a coming together of the new media to try and help, at the very least, inform people of the risks they're taking.
Jason Motlog, did you see those kind of shakedowns on the path when you were alongside migrants? Did they have stories of halfway through the route, they're suddenly being told you have to cough up more money if you want me to continue taking you?
Yeah, just about everybody had experienced a shakedown at some point, whether from coyotes, smugglers, or police. And roundly, people said that Colombia was the worst country they had passed through. Some had been shaken down multiple times, and you know, a lot of them will sew their cash inside their pants. And in the case of several, they actually had to strip down their pants, and their money was cut out of their pants by police, and they were sent on. And there's absolutely nothing they can do. But you know, it starts, as Leonard said, at the very beginning. One of the Bangladeshis claimed that he had to pay $10,000, which is an astronomical sum, almost improbable, to arrange a visa and transport to South America. And then once you know you're at the cusp of the Darien, a lot of these people typically pay about $700 to smugglers to take them in boats. But the people that we travel with had paid sort of incrementally, so it would be one smuggler takes them to the next junction, and then another one picks them up, and you know, they're told it's going to be this amount at this junction, but then it's twice the amount. And you know, we even experience that as travelers through the region.
Then there's the question of what is to be done with these people if they actually make it to their destination. If someone is able to cross the border into the United States, and at that point they are found by some border patrol, do we send them back? Do we have to simply say, I know you've gone through terrible things, but there is law and order, and if you didn't come here legally, you have to go home. And we have some callers who have thoughts about that. Let's go to some of them. This is Gina calling from Akron, Ohio. Gina, what do we do when people show up?
Well, actually, I wanted to ask your guests what they would think on that. And I really wanted to thank you for putting light stories like this. I think a previous caller really hit the nail on the head, but this humanizes a lot of migrants and refugees that we have a very vague picture of where they're coming from and why they're fleeing, and it really helps to give a face to it and humanize them and really see the whole width and breadth of all these people fleeing. But I wanted to ask your guests if they had any recommendations, especially during this current political climate, if they could see just a change specifically in the U.S. policy or how we treat or entertain migrants and refugees, what they would like to see happen, or policy changes, if they had any specific ideas.
Leonard Doyle, would you weigh in on that?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I must say that the United States is remarkably generous towards refugees and resettlement, as is Canada. They've taken enormous steps in comparison to many European countries. They've been absolutely extraordinary. But at the same time, you know, a lot of people come in without papers, and they are not, they can't pass the asylum test, so they're deemed to be economic migrants. And those typically are sent home. They're usually deported. And that's a very tough thing for any country to do. But at the end of the day, countries have a right to manage their borders. If they don't manage their borders very well, very strange things happen in the politics, as we're seeing in Europe, where the extreme right is kind of creeping its way into power. And I think that's the big risk about migration. It's a very touchy subject. People get very passionate about it on both sides of the argument. But you need a degree of managed borders. I don't think anybody would argue for open borders these days and expect to be taken seriously. But at the same time, you have to leave a space for people who are fleeing persecution. And they're not just refugees. I mean, the refugees are terribly, terribly important, and they're the central part of it. People who have a well-founded sphere of persecution from a government for their religion, sex, opinions, whatever. But there are also people who've suffered torture not by their government, are being discriminated against. Maybe they're being discriminated against in the workplace. Maybe they can't work. So you can have pregnant women, for example, who come as economic migrants, but their children arrive. So I think we have to have a much more kind of nuanced view of who is entitled to stay once they make that journey. But the bigger picture that we're really not discussing today is why people leave. And the great reason people leave is because of corruption at home. they realize that they've kind of reached the limit of what they can do in their lives. They're willing to take these crazy risks, put everything at risk, because they're stuck somehow or other, whether through oppression, economic blockage, discrimination against women, gay, lesbian discrimination, not to mention the war and oppression that we get for refugees.
Let's hear from another caller. This is Peter calling from Boston. Peter, welcome to On Point.
Yes. Again, I think everybody has empathy and sympathy for the plight of the refugees. That being said, I have to say, it sounds to me, although the gentleman is not talking about open borders, I mean, everybody that's wants to come, if they could have a bridge, everybody would come from South America and Mexico into the United States. You have 2 million Muslims have crossed over to Europe. I mean, you see what's happening. I mean, do you have empathy for? Absolutely. But no country can absorb everybody. I mean, you think of it. And of course, what is every refugee? They're either going to claim they're persecuted by the government, economic, or the women are being, brutalized. And understand that may be the case. But no society, in history, nobody's been able. You just can't take everybody. Why not? As an alternative, like we have the military set up. Refugee places in their country to give them three squares, thoughts and cotton, and give them medical. But I mean, how can we take everybody? I mean, nobody. Obama's just another 70,000 people. You just can't take everybody. And it seems to me the breakdown is where we're going in this election is the Democrats with Hillary. It's going to be open borders. Nobody gets kicked out. Everybody who can reach here stays. They send their kids, recently, the children who've been coming out without accompanied adults have been there hundreds last year and like 100,000. And now what they're doing, because nobody will take them, they're now going back to the people in where they came from and letting the relatives come up. So it just seems to me it's like insane. I mean, how can we keep taking, absorbing people? I'm not talking about migration.
Sure. Peter, thanks for the thinking. Leonard Doyle.
These are important points, but I think it's also, points to the fact that people get very upset about migration, and quite often the detail gets lost. If the United States is welcoming 70,000, in fact more, refugees who are being resettled, this is a tip of the iceberg. Resettlement is always just a tiny piece of it, and it's for the most vulnerable, the people who are potentially about to be wiped off the face of the earth or who are incredibly vulnerable. This is an act of extreme generosity which must be supported. But resettlement is always only going to be a small piece of it. The bigger piece of it is how do you deal with the countries of origin? How do we deal with the corruption? How do we make it so that people have an opportunity, so that economies grow? And on the point of refugee camps, indeed, that's what you see all over the world. I mean, the generosity of countries around countries of conflict is extraordinary. Kenya absorbs so many refugees, Jordan, so many millions of refugees from Syria. Turkey is the biggest refugee resettlement holding country in the world at the moment. So I think, we throw things around as if people are pouring over the borders of developed countries. It's just not the case. Sometimes it comes across like that because politicians might want us to believe that, but simply not the case.
Jason Motlogh, I want to turn the conversation away from migration for a minute, because when I was doing research for this segment, I came across several travel websites that were basically discussing the best way for travelers to get through or over or around the Darien Gap. There are companies that tell you ways you can ship your vehicles. Now, this is certainly not always safe. There was a case in 2013 of a Swedish tourist who disappeared. His body was finally recovered last year. They think that he would have been kidnapped and killed by a drug gang. But there certainly is an element, it seems, of, for some people, adventure travel. And then, coincidentally, I got an email this morning from a former producer who said, I'm excited you're doing a whole hour on the Darien Gap. I've been sort of obsessed with it for years since it's the only interruption on the Pan-American Highway. And the main reason I bought my camper van stems from a burning desire to drive all the way to the tip of Argentina. So, Jason Motlogh, did you find sometimes that there were travelers, tourists in the same areas that the migrants might be?
Well, when we were in Turbo, there were some that were getting on the same boat towards the Caribbean. And a lot of these folks are going to head off to the beaches and resorts along the coast and, have cocktails. And the migrants in some cases are walking right past or diverting deeper into the jungle to elude border patrols and get inside Panama. So there is that element. A lot of what you see advertised as the Darien Gap on chat rooms and adventure websites, it's a little misleading. These aren't people who are actually running the gap, going through the jungle proper. Often, if it's a vehicle, it has to be ferried around on a boat. There have been cases of expeditions, you know, moving 10 feet a day, where a vehicle has been hauled through the bush back in the 60s and 70s. But the conditions are so dangerous and fluid right now that you don't see any of that. And as you said, the last time, the case of the Swedish traveler who took the same route that we wound up taking, but was not prepared, didn't have prior approval, had a GPS device on him and was suspected of being a spy and was ultimately executed by the FARC. And so it's still very treacherous. And I've been told recently that several more Americans who I think were trying to cross on motorbikes have vanished. Mm. They're still missing.
Jason, one more piece of sound I want to play from the footage gathered for your documentary in the works. And this is a group that had finally crossed into Panama. Their spirits lift. They're pausing by a border marker at a mountain. And this is a exchange with Ibrima, someone from Gambia. He said he had gotten word he was on a government hit list and that agents had come to his house to look for him. So he fled. 2 weeks later, he's in Central America, and you ask him how he's doing. Here's that exchange.
How do you feel? You think you can make it all the way?
Yeah, I'll make it, inshallah. By the grace of God, I will make it. Because I think the hardest side of the journey is almost done. These 3 days is the hardest time in my entire life, man. What I encountered, man, I never encountered this throughout my life. It's too hard.
So some people do make it significantly through. Sometimes they realize that they didn't know what they were getting into. People make this trip. People are driven to make this trip. Thanks to both of you for talking about this. This has been Leonard Doyle, Director of the Media and Communication for the International Organization for Migration. Leonard, thank you very much for your time from Geneva. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
And also journalist-filmmaker Jason Motlog, whose story about the migrant trek through the Darien Gap is in Outside Magazine now. Jason, we're glad you made it out. Thank you very much for your time and for talking about this.
Thank you, Sasha.
Continue the conversation or get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, a friend remembers a powerful artist whose life was more than he could bear. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.